Hello, horror guys and gals, and welcome back to the We Love Horror podcast, the podcast where we talk about everything and anything horror. I'm Michael, and today I'm joined by a very special guest. He's directed films such as Extremity, The Last Shift, so many good movies. Anthony DeBlasi, how are you today?
Good. Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. I'm really happy. Like, I don't know. And I know that we had a chat about this film beforehand, like about, you know, getting together and doing this film, but I just wanted to say that I never thought in a million years I would be interviewing the director of The Last Shift, because that's like one of my favorite films. So I just never thought that, you know, when I saw that movie that I'd be interviewing you about it. So it's so cool. Well,
thank you. I mean, thanks for talking about it and spreading it to the fans. The more people that can see it, the better.
Of course. I feel like it definitely deserves all the recognition it's gotten and more. So I think it's a great film. And I think all the films that you've made are super amazing. Like, Most Likely to Die, one of my favorites.
Good. Well, right. You said Scream was your all time.
Yeah. Scream's probably my all time favorite horror movie, but, your Last Shift film is probably in my top 10, I'd have to say.
All right, good. I'll take it.
But yeah, thank you again for wanting to come on today. I'm really excited.
Of course. Can't wait to dig into it.
Yeah. And I figured before we started to kind of, you know, just kind of break the ice a little bit, make it kind of loosey goosey, I thought, do you want to do a 5-question horror edition round where I just ask you 5 questions?
Yeah, let's do it. Is there a timer on these questions? Am I like, is this like Jeopardy? Am I under pressure?
Oh, no pressure at all.
do I have to answer correctly?
You have to answer them correctly or you die. Just kidding.
I knew it. This was a trap.
This is a trap. I have your entire house booby trapped right now. So choose your answers wisely, Anthony.
Damn you.
But yeah, I just figured it'd be kind of a fun way for us to kind of, you know, chit chat for a minute before we get into the actual discussion. So I figured if, I could ask you a question first, and then you could ask me a question, and then I could ask you a question, and, you know, back and forth.
All right, deal.
So the first question I have for you, Anthony, is if you could only watch 5 horror movies for the rest of your life, what films would you choose?
Oh, that's like 5 questions in one. All right, but it's pretty good. So horror, definitely The Lost Boys.
Good choice.
Definitely The Shining.
Even better choice.
I'd have to put the first Scream on there. And then Fright Night.
Ooh. The original or the remake?
The original.
Okay.
Fright Night, and then probably American Werewolf in London.
Those are solid. Those are all solid choices.
I mean, I love the old, like, creature heavy movies from that era, which are, you know, they're not like the scariest movies, but they just, I'm drawn to the creature effects, and those are really effects heavy movies of time period.
And especially for that time period. I was just chatting with another podcast about an episode that I just recently did on The Howling, and we were talking about how great the effects still are in that movie. And it's just, it's crazy how practical effects have come such a long way. So
I know.
Yeah, those are great choices. I love those choices. So
all right. So what's the first horror movie you remember seeing?
The first horror movie I remember seeing was The Ring, because that was like the first movie that my parents actually let me sit down and watch, because I was, I guess, old enough to watch a movie like that. And yeah, it scared the shit out of me.
Come watch this Ring movie.
Yeah. I was convinced that I was going to die in 7 days after I watched it. I really was.
I gotta be honest. I don't think to this day, I mean, I'm like this, I'm superstitious, but there are certain things, you know, where it's like about a cursed whatever Mm-hmm. I usually don't look at it. You know, yeah. Like, I don't think I've watched that videotape in the ring. I've watched that movie a dozen times, but like I'm just like, okay, I'm not going to watch this because it's probably cursed.
Watch it with one eye.
I'll watch on and off, see it like a little bit at a time.
It doesn't count unless I've watched the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that is a rule, I would say, right? It doesn't totally affect you unless you watch the whole thing. Exactly. So how old were you when you saw it?
I think I was nine or 10. I believe I was 9 or 10. And my parents are practical jokers. So my parents decided it would be funny to hook up the phone line we had two phone lines in the house. So as soon as I was done watching the actual videotape portion of the movie, they called the house phone and pretended to, and I was, you know, 9 year old me, of course, is, you know, freaked the hell out.
I mean, that's cruel. That's cruel.
Oh, trust me. My parents have done worse than that. But I'll tell a quick story real quick, not to get too much off subject, but I had a Halloween party once. I used to have Halloween parties every year. And I used to have people from high school come and hang out. And I remember one specific year we had the garage all like decked out, decorated and stuff. And
yeah.
We had a TV out there and we had like a bunch of chairs and stuff and everyone was sitting out there. And somehow my parents had figured out how to hook the TV that we had in the garage to the TV in the living room to like play whatever the TV in the living room was playing. And so halfway through the movie that we were all watching, they put in the ring part where she starts coming out of the well. And everybody in the Halloween party started freaking out. Like my friend Dan, he ran down the street, probably about peed his pants, I think, and was like,
who's doing this?
Yeah. Cause she's here. Yeah, we didn't know how it was happening. So we were like, what the hell? So we all like, my parents have been known to play many a pranks on
me. And then everyone's cell phone rings.
Pretty much. I'd have to say The Ring was the very first one I actually sat down and watched all the way through. So pretty effective movie, I would say, for the time.
Definitely.
Okay, so if you could assemble a team of 5 horror villains to save the world against a greater evil, who would you choose and why?
Oh, man.
I told you these questions were broad. That's why when I texted you earlier, I was like, I narrowed it down to 5 because I think 10 is a little much.
Well, you know, okay. So Freddy Krueger, right? Ghostface.
Solid.
I mean, I think... You need a heavy, so it's either going to be Jason or Leatherface. I have to go with Leatherface.
Yeah.
You know, because he's got a motorized killing machine, you know, not just a machete. And he I think he follow orders better. Even in the movie, you tell he follows orders quite well yelled at. let's say, I think Chucky, because you need like the spy.
Ooh, yeah, the sneak attack.
The sneak attack. You need, and I think Patrick Bateman.
Ooh, from American Psycho. That's
for the sex appeal, right? If you need to like seduce, Patrick Bateman's your guy.
There we go. Yeah. I didn't even think about that. I didn't even think about the whole like, you know, distraction, seducing type of deal. Very charming. You need someone that's charming.
Yeah, and he'd probably be like, him and Freddie would vie for leadership.
Probably.
You know, I think they would, you know, always be one-upping each other. I think so.
Totally agree.
Okay. I have a two-part question. What is your, and this will get to horror, but what is your favorite romantic comedy?
Oh, romantic comedy. That's a tough one because there's a lot of good ones.
I threw you for a loop. You're like, damn it, I'm not ready for the romantic comedy question.
No, you're good. I would probably have to say I'm just gonna go with the classic. I'm gonna go with Mean Girls. I'd have to say Mean Girls.
Oh yeah, Mean Girls. All right. So this is my horror question.
Okay.
Lindsay Lohan from Mean Girls. What horror movie would she be the best final girl in?
Ooh, good question. Are we talking about like old Lindsay Lohan pre-rehab or after rehab Lindsay Lohan?
I'd say Mean Girls Lindsay.
Okay.
Two different kinds of horror films.
Yeah. Just wanted to specify before we got into that.
I was like, are we talking like Requiem of a Dream, Lindsay Lohan?
Oh man. I personally think that she'd be a better Julie James for I Know What You Did Last Summer, honestly. I feel like
Yeah,
because I just feel like the character of Julie James, it's not Jennifer Love Hewitt's fault. She's a great actress. It's just they don't do a whole lot with her character. So
they don't.
I just feel like Lindsay Lohan would be more proactive in that aspect, I think.
She's extremely breathy in that movie. It's everything she does is like filled with this heaving breath.
She's like, yeah, I'm doing this, and then, yeah, I don't know. It's just
we can't throw the guy in the ocean. That's just wrong.
Oh man. Yeah, no, I'd have to go with Lindsay Lohan and I Know What We Did Last Summer to beat out Jennifer Love Hewitt.
There's an alternate reality right now forming on that question alone.
Exactly. Oh man. I guess this is kind of a similar question to what you just asked me. I guess not really, but if you could live the life of any horror character for a day, who would you choose?
Oh, that's one that lives, I guess.
And it can be like a horror villain, horror, hero, whatever.
Let me think about this.
I know. Sorry. I gave you like,
it has to be Michael from the Lost Boys.
Ooh.
Michael from the Lost Boys was my first Instagram post. Cause he's like the coolest vampire to me that's ever lived.
He really is.
And I got a new pair of sunglasses. Let's see. My wife was like, you look like you're in the Lost Boys. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Well, then that's exactly what I'm going for.
Yeah. Right. That's the vibe.
That's the vibe. Then I have succeeded.
I love it.
Adam.
Oh man. All that's right. A good choice.
You have to.
No, I like that choice. I love The Lost Boys. That's one of my favorite vampire movies. So,
I mean, that movie's brilliant. I don't, you know what it is? It's funny. It's like, you know, I'm older than you, obviously. Growing up in that era.
Yeah.
It was funny because there was a time when that era became like super cheesy. And now looking back, now in that time, I think everyone wishes it was the 80s again.
Yeah.
And it's funny because like there's a high art to those movies. They've like transcended whatever was cheesy about them. And now they're like high art.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like watching like Masters of the Universe. And I'm like, the other day I turned it on. I'm like, this is like the Mona Lisa of our time. You know,
right.
It's like, it's something about it that in Lost Boys falls in that category of like Joel Schumacher just did a great job putting that movie together and the music and everything.
Oh, just everything about it is just so amazing. So perfect. I don't feel like there's anything that I would change about that movie at all. Like,
no. And it's funny. I went to the premiere of the sequel, which was years.
Cool.
So it was years later. This was when I was in, I mean, it was like 2000, I don't know. Late 2000, like 2008, 2009, 2010. I don't know. But they brought, so the director was there. They brought this guy in and he was like, oh, this movie's going to be cool. Not like the first movie.
Yeah.
And we were all there. We had watched the first movie. It was like, they had, like Corey Feldman was there. They had like a special screening. It's like, cool. Dude, you don't know your audience because this audience loves this movie.
Yeah.
And Warner Brothers made the sequel wanting to like make fun of the original film. And I was like, that's crazy to me. Cause it's like everyone who's here to watch this movie loves that first movie. We don't want you to make fun of it.
Yeah. That's crazy. That's so cool that you were at the premiere of the second one though. Like,
I mean, it was fun. But the audience wasn't happy.
Wasn't a very pleasant experience.
No. Well, not when you like dissed the first movie.
Right. Oh, but, man. Yeah, I've always wondered what it would be like to, like, I think Scream and Halloween are two movies that I wish I could have been there to see in the theater when they first came out because, I wasn't alive during Halloween, obviously, and I wasn't old enough to go see Scream yet. So, but
I don't have a very good memory when it comes to like childhood stuff. I can still vividly remember opening night of Scream. The theater, what it looked like. It was packed. And it was, you could feel that energy in the air because it, you would just come after this really kind of low point in horror cinema where, like, you know, Freddy and Jason and all the icons, you know, Michael Myers, all those movies were just spitting out, like Freddy's Dead was, had just come out, you know, like the worst of the batches. And, you know, horror was on this downturn and that movie came out and just people, the beginning of that movie still to this day, right? One of the best 10 minutes in any movie, let alone horror movie. And the audience was like, holy shit, this movie's going to be amazing. Everyone was like, everyone was blown away by that opening sequence and like how it was a total fresh take, you know, on horror films.
So good. Yeah. That's one movie that I wish I could have experienced like when it first came out, but there's just something different, like going to see a horror movie in the theater than watching it on at home on your TV. I don't know. There's just something. And with, you know, with COVID and the quarantine and stuff, it's killing me not being able to go see movies in the theater. I can't tell you the last time I saw a movie in the theater now.
It's been it's the worst.
A long time. Like
so hard to be like, cause we would go to the movies like every weekend.
Yeah.
And not to be able to do that is so hard.
Yeah. And I think the last movie I went and saw was back in January when I went and saw Underwater in theaters. That was the last movie I ever got to see in a theater because, you know, after that, that's when lockdown came. So
lockdown, yeah. We saw that when it came out. And the last one we were just talking about, the last one we saw was Invisible Man.
Oh, okay. That one was the last one I saw, actually. Because The Invisible Man, when did that come out? March?
I think it was March, yeah.
March, yeah.
So we saw it. We were literally like the only people in the theater because they had already started. People were already kind of locking themselves down, but the movie, people were not going. We were literally, we had dinner. We went to the Arclight down here, which is this like, they don't let like kids go and stuff.
Yeah.
We had dinner and saw Invisible Man and no one was there. It was empty.
Wow. That would probably be cool though, just to sit in an empty theater without anybody else. So,
yeah.
But yeah, sorry, that was a long tangent. I didn't mean to go off of like too much off subject with that. But
So you just directed a movie, right?
Oh well, it's a film that I've been working on for the last 7 years. Actually, it's been quite an undertaking to finish because I started when I was in college still. So 2013 is when we started filming it. And it was just a really like the production of it was really rushed because one of the characters that's in it, he was actually leaving to go into the Navy soon. So literally it was a pretty hectic production when we first started it. And it was a very big learning experience for me because I just had to learn how to like micromanage everything and like try to, you know, get everything done in a timely manner. So it taught me how to be, you know, timely with everything and make sure that I get everything done when I need to. But also it taught me how to make sure you get all the stuff you need when you have the chance to get it. Because, you know, there's some shots where I thought to myself when we were filming, I was like, okay, just get the big stuff out of the way first and we can go back and shoot like the, you know, like the insert shots, like say someone's reaching for something and it's a close-up shot or, you know, just those little close-up shots that go in between like the, you know, there were some scenes that we didn't film that stuff and it bit me in the ass because when I came back later, I was like, oh crap, we didn't film that. So I had to film filler shots and I had to try to match it as good as I could to what we had already filmed like years later. So that was one of the
years later. Yeah.
Yeah. I think because we filmed the ending to it a couple years ago, actually 2 years ago this month, we filmed the ending to it because we didn't actually get an ending filmed when we filmed it back in 2013 because I ended up moving to Kansas. So we didn't get an ending And, you know, for a while I was like sitting there like, okay, well, that's fine. I guess we'll just have a half finished movie, whatever. But then I was like, no, I want to finish it. So I practically, begged my friend to like be back in it. Cause he was like, oh, I don't want to have to grow my hair out again. I don't want to have to look exactly the same. And I was like, I know, but I want an ending so bad. So we did it. And, yeah, it was fun, but there were filler shots that I filmed like 5 years after the fact. So, but
how does it look?
It looks pretty good.
Like does he look much different?
Oh yeah. He definitely looks a little different. But it's not too distracting, I don't think, but those filler shots that I filmed look pretty dang good. Like you can't even tell that
that's good.
If I wasn't to tell you which ones are filler shots, I don't know if you would notice.
That's the one thing, like not the one thing, but like something you learn when making a movie and then editing the movie and releasing the movie is, you know, people don't see anything most of the time.
Yeah.
If people are watching the movie, you can change so much in a scene and they don't, you know, I'm not a big continuity person. When I shoot, I don't worry about things because I want my actors to be in the moment.
Yeah.
So I don't make them follow continuity.
Yeah.
So when I edit, you know, you kind of have to throw that kind of stuff out the window. You're like, but that doesn't match and that doesn't match and that doesn't match. I'm like, I don't care. Nobody sees that shit. Like, it doesn't matter. It's not what's important. People don't notice it.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. Like, you'd rather your actors be in the moment than, you know, make sure that everything is, you know, set up perfectly in the next scene so that it matches.
Yeah. Like if there's a cup in their hand doing like, whoa, what did I do with this? Or where was my hand when I was doing this? I'm like, who cares? Nobody cares.
just keep doing what you're doing.
Just do what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. That was your question, right?
That was, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you answered it, you know, you answered, cause I was going to ask you like, what was the most challenging part of it? But I think you answered the timeline probably.
Yeah. So because he had to, you know, we had to do all of his stuff first. So every scene that he's either in by himself or with the other main character, we all shot that first. So literally when I released the film, eventually, I think in the next month or so, the very first scene that comes up in that film is the very last scene that we filmed.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So it's literally like we filmed everything like backwards. So it was kind of stressful, but I think, you know, and I was still learning. Like I was still learning like a lot about film and, you know, making my first, like, it's about a 30-minute long film. So it's not a feature length film, but it's not like a short film either. So it was just my first experience making a film like that. So I think I learned a lot. I'm proud of it. I mean,
yeah.
I feel like I've gotten leaps and bounds better, but I think it's still,
you just got to dive in and do it, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to you seeing that, Anthony. Hopefully,
yeah, me too.
Hopefully you like it. So, but,
We'll see. We'll see.
I don't know. I'm my own worst critic. So I sit there and pick it apart every time I watch it. I'm like, oh, I wish I would have done that differently. Or, you know,
what'd your sister say?
She likes it.
Well, good then.
So
that's all that matters.
That's true. My sister's opinion is the one of the only ones that matters. Cause like, I usually ask her for everything. I even asked her before we started. I was like, does this intro sound okay? Okay. And I like went through the intro with her and she's like, oh yeah, that sounds really good. I was like, good.
She'll tell you the truth.
Yes. Oh, she's not afraid.
She's like, that sucked.
Yeah. She's like, that sucks. Start over. So Anthony, question number four, who are your top three favorite final girls?
Oh, well, geez. All right. Well, Sydney Prescott. I mean, you know, probably Laurie Strode. Cause she's, you know, I love A Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm a big Nightmare on Elm Street fan, but I don't like Nancy that much. I think she's a little, I don't know.
Annoying.
Yeah. Annoying. You know, Laurie's got like, she's tough, you know, and yeah. she's heroic. And then let's see, I'm going to say, Gabby from Most Likely to Die, my movie.
Ooh, that's
Heather Morris. Come on.
That's a great one. That's a great one.
Gotta give props.
Yes, that's a great choice. Those are all three. Those are great, solid choices. So good ones.
All right, thanks. I passed that. Good.
Yes, you did. We don't have to drop the trap door yet into the spikes.
I've survived so far.
Yeah.
All right. So what movie inspired you most as a filmmaker? And not just, I mean, any movie. What movie wanted you to be, make you make movies?
Ooh, okay. I'm going to try to go off on a short tangent for this one because I'm very, very passionate about this movie. But I'd have to say The Grudge from 2004.
Cool.
And I'm sure everyone that's listening to this or that will listen to this is so sick of me talking about how much I love that movie, but I feel like I bring it up in almost every single episode that I've ever done so far on this podcast. But that film to me is not just a good film, but it's very nostalgic for me because like you were saying, when you went and saw Scream, you remember exactly everything. You remember, you know, what the theater looked like. You remember, you know, just the experience of being there. And that's the same with The Grudge, because The Grudge was the first horror movie that I was allowed to go see in theaters. I mean, of course I had to beg my parents to let me go see it because they were like, that looks too scary. And I was like, no, please let me go see it. It looks so good.
Yeah.
And so I basically had to beg my parents to let me go see it. In the promise that I would not sleep in their bed the next night. <Yeah. laughs> So I promised them, I was like, I promise I won't have to come sleep with you guys. Just let me go see this movie. I was like 11. I believe I was 10 or 11 when that film came out. So I remember going to the theater and I just remember like sitting down and the movie just starting. And that movie just honestly changed everything for me. I mean, I had always kind of known that film was something that I wanted to get into. Even a really young age, but that film really solidified what I wanted to do. And I've known that I've wanted to do film ever since then. So for the past 16 years, I've known exactly what I wanted to do with my life is to make horror films. And it just, that movie just inspired me so much because I don't know. I just remember after that, I had my own video camera and I would just make stupid little short films. And it was just, I don't know. It just sparked something in me.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what it is. It's like, it's going to be something that is of your era, right? It's like something that hit you at the right time, at the right place. So it's like, it's all based on when that movie came out and when you got to see it. So it's like, it makes sense that it would be, you know, the Grudge.
Exactly. Yeah.
Have you ever seen A Tale of Two Sisters? Is that what it's called?
Yes. I've seen the Korean version and I've seen the remake of it called The Uninvited.
Oh yeah. Which I don't think I've ever seen the remake, but yeah, the original, which I love that movie.
It's really good.
So to the audience, if you haven't seen A Tale of Two Sisters, watch it.
Check it out. Yeah.
Cause that movie also has a lot of scary daytime stuff.
Yeah.
Which is hard to, you know, which is like in The Last Shift, most of that movie takes place in very bright light. And I, you know, I wanted to do that intentionally. I'm like, if you can scare people with the lights on, then you're doing something right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was something that was actually something I did want to bring up to you when we get into the Last Shift discussion, is because I did notice that. I noticed that it takes place in a very bright police station. It's, you know, it's an old police station, of course, but it's not like, the lighting doesn't look dingy. The lighting doesn't look like super creepy or anything. It just looks like normal.
Spooky. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. So that was something I definitely wanted to bring up with you when we get into that. But that's basically the movie that just really inspired me and started not only my love for film, but my like jump started my love for horror films as well. Because I remember after that movie, when it came out on DVD, my parents bought it for me. And I think I wore out the first DVD after like the first few years of watching it. Cause literally I have probably seen The Grudge more times than I've seen any other movie in my entire life, aside from Titanic, of course, cause I've seen that movie plenty of times, but
of course.
I mean, I can recite that movie to you with my eyes closed. I can probably act out the whole movie for you if I really wanted to, but.
And that's like watching two movies at once.
Yeah. But, so my final question for you, Anthony, is would you rather spend an entire week at the Overlook Hotel from The Shining, or would you rather spend a week at the Bates Motel from Psycho?
Oh, the Bates Motel for sure. As I said, like the Shining, just that movie freaked me out. And it still freaks me out. Like, and there's not a lot of movies. I look at horror movies kind of like with a clinical eye.
Yeah.
But The Shining always really freaked me out. Everything about that movie. And you know, it's funny because it's like a huge portion of that movie. I think Kubrick gets all the credit for the movie, but it's really such a big part of that movie is Penderecki's music, which was not made for the movie. You know, it's like that movie it existed and Kubrick just put it in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that music, and you know, like Joe Bishara, who did, you know, does Insidious, you know, some amazing scores.
Yeah.
And Joe actually introduced me to, because I was talking to Joe about doing Last Shift. Mm-hmm. Joe introduced me to Adam Barber, two of my friends at the same time introduced me to the composer of Last Shift, which is my buddy Adam Girosh, and then Joe Bishara. I was like, well, I better hire this guy if they're both saying his name at the same time.
Yeah.
But, you know, his music is also very, like, can you imagine watching Insidious without that music?
Oh, no, not
at all. And would it be anywhere near as scary without that music? Maybe not.
Yeah.
And I think The Shining is kind of the same way. Yeah. Not to take anything away from the movie, but the music, I feel like, is like 50% of it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. And I actually, on the episode that I did of Jaws, we talked about how I feel like music is so like essential for any movie, not just horror movies, but horror movies, especially because without the music, you know, it wouldn't be as effective. Like I remember reading the story about how John Carpenter showed his film to somebody when it was edited without the music. And they basically were like, this movie's garbage. Like, yeah. He's not that good. And then he showed him again with the music and he was like, holy crap, that changes everything. Like
everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just feel like music is so essential. And I just feel like it's very also not as talked about as it should be.
Yeah. So. No, it's true. It's true. And not to say, and listen, Psycho obviously has one of the most iconic songs in all of movie history, but you really think about that one piece of music. It's so iconic in Psycho. But yes, the Bates Motel, I feel like I could survive at the Bates Motel. I don't know about the Overlook Hotel.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I'd probably choose the Overlook Hotel just because I've always had that fear. And even before I ever watched Psycho, I've always had that fear of, you know, I don't like showering when I'm home alone. Cause I'm like, yeah. what if somebody was to break into my house right now while I'm in the shower, what the hell would I do? I'd be basically screwed. So it's like, I don't know. I don't think I'm about to stay at a hotel where I'm going to get attacked by a knife wielding maniac in a shower. Like
who is first watching you in the shower and then killing you.
Yeah. Because I feel like the Torrance family lasted a pretty long time in the hotel before shit started going down. So I think that
that's true.
Only spending a week there, I don't think it would be too bad.
they should remake the Shining and put it like in the summertime, and then they just drive away.
Right? They're just like, okay, shit's getting too real. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Yeah.
The ghosts are like, thank God it's winter.
Right. Woo! Oh man. But yeah, that was fun. Thank you for wanting to participate in the 5-question lightning round. That was fun.
That's good. That's good. I survived and that's all that matters.
No trap doors opened on you today. I'll try.
Traps sprung.
Rats. I'll try next. Rats. Time. Just kidding. but I guess without further ado, do you want to get into the discussion of your film, The Last Shift, Anthony?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I really, really just adore this movie, Anthony. I remember the first time my sister and I watched it, like sat down and watched it, because I remember at the time it was streaming on Netflix.
Yeah.
And we sat down and watched it because I was hooked from the poster. I love the poster. Like I was just like, oh, I want to know what this movie's about. And so I just love this film. Like it has, like you were saying with The Shining, how it scares you. I feel like that's how The Last Shift is as well. I feel like you did such a good job with creating like an undertone of just uneasiness the entire movie. Like regardless of something's happening in the scene or not, it's just still, you're waiting for something to happen. And I mean, I feel like I've seen so many movies these days, like nothing really gets to me anymore. Like, I've seen a lot of movies and this movie really, really stuck with me, and it scared the crap out of me and my sister. My sister was terrified after watching this movie. She was like, yeah, I'm not going anywhere by myself for a while. Like, it just had this like profound effect on the both of us, and it just stuck with us. And I've just loved that film ever since. So,
well, thank you. You know, and it's awesome. Like, making a movie that scares horror fans, you know, because it's because like we were talking about, you watch so many of them that you just kind of become numb to it.
Yeah.
And when you can, like, you know, some people don't, I mean, some people watch horror because they like that thrill, but a lot of us watch it because we like it, but it doesn't affect us like that first couple movies we've seen.
Yeah. So
I'm glad to be able to make a movie that can still scare horror fans.
Yeah. And it's so good. I was curious to ask you about what gave you the idea to make this film, like what inspired you? Cause I know that there's like definite inspiration, obviously, from like the Manson family and stuff like that, which is a really cool element, I think.
The whole Scott Poyley, who I co-wrote that movie with. So he had produced two movies I did prior, which was Casadega and Missionary. And, you know, Casadega was like a supernatural kind of giallo type movie. And then, you know, Missionary is like a Fatal Attraction thriller. And, you know, we had spent a lot more money on those movies. And I was like, Scott, why don't we do like a really, like a challenge, a really small contained movie that is all based around the sound design? Because I had gotten to know the sound. I had worked with the same sound team on those prior two movies. And I had this idea called, that's at the time I was calling it Dispatch. And in our shooting, when we were writing the movie, it was called Dispatch, like all my early things, of a, you know, of this lone person at a dispatch office, and everything is just bombarded on them through sound.
Yeah.
And you can really, knowing that what the sound team could do, I wanted to write a whole movie around that. So we sat down and then it, you know, it changed along the way, and inspirations from like Wes Craven inspired me a lot, like Nightmare on Elm Street, and then the Manson family.
Yeah.
You know, specifically this documentary called Manson, which was this documentary that was not released. It was nominated for an Oscar the year it came out, but it was never released in theaters because it was right when the trials were going on.
Oh.
So it got like pulled. I did not pull this out. I let somebody borrow this and they gave it back to me. So look at this. So when I was making this movie, you can't get this in stores. So I had to order it from the guy who made the movie, or the team that made, they were in.
Wow.
The person that made this, Robert Hendrickson, was at the commune. He was part of, you know, what you call, you wouldn't call him the Manson family, because that has,
right.
but you know, part of the guys who lived on the ranch.
Wow.
So look at this. My name's on it.
That's right? So cool.
it's signed, right? Authored by, this is like just a burned disc. They make these, but it was made in 73. They make these, you know, you have to request it and get it from them directly. This is amazing.
That, you know, I want to get my hands on that. I definitely want to get my own copy of that now, because that's so cool.
When I got this movie, I opened it. It literally smelled like somebody's farm. Like, it smelled like a barn.
Really?
And I was like, it's incredible. But it's an excellent documentary. And I made everyone watch it when we made the movie. But that was very inspiring, because it really got you into the minds of everyone who was living there at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. And that was something I also wanted to bring up as well, because I felt like as far as casting goes, everybody in this movie was so, so good. Especially the main actress, Juliana Harkavy. Is that how you say her name? Yeah. She was fantastic in this movie. And I loved all the people that you chose for the cult members as well. I thought they all did fantastic. And I thought it was really interesting to see like how they interacted. Like when you see the police footage of them talking to the officer, being interviewed by the officer, and you can tell they're just batshit crazy out of their minds. Like, but I loved that because it's like you watch interviews with the Manson members of the Manson family, and that's kind of how they are. They're just kind of not connected with reality in any way, shape, or form. They're just completely they're in their own world, and they just think that all these things are like a normal way of life. And it's just like, that's not normal at all.
That's not normal. And I think we got a lot of that, you know, that kind of mindset from, you know, watching those interviews and things with Manson. But Juliana is, she's great. I mean, she was a local, we shot that movie in Florida, and she'd lived, you know, she was, I think, traveling between Florida and Georgia, which a lot of the actors do in that area. We had met her. I think I met her when we did Missionary. She helped us during casting sessions, and she just was such a great actress. And so I think we offered her the part. I don't believe we did any casting. I mean, we did some LA casting. I was in Florida. We did some remote LA casting just to see, but we offered her the part pretty early on. And I don't even believe she auditioned for it when we gave it to her.
That's awesome.
And that's such a, you have to carry the whole movie. You know, she's in every second of the film.
Yeah.
And it's all from her point of view. So.
And she's fantastic in it. Like until you just said that you basically gave her the part without like an audition, like that's amazing to me. That's awesome that, you know, you had that much faith in her to be able to carry this whole movie, that, you know, you didn't even have to put her through the audition process or anything like that. You're just like, do you want this role? Cool. Awesome. Her, I'm going to give it to you. That's that's awesome.
She knocked it out of the park for sure.
She really did. And I also love how, aside from just the perfect casting of this film, I love the different places that this film goes, like psychologically, because there's questions that I wanted to ask you specifically, because there were certain things where I was like, I can't tell if she's like, just, well, obviously like in some parts she's imagining some of these things, but I specifically wanted to ask you about like the homeless guy. Is he dead the whole time? Like from the start of the film, is she seeing like some sort of like a flashback type of deal? Like he's someone that was like killed in the cell. Was he in the cell with them when they brought them in and they killed him too?
We had a whole backstory with the homeless guy. So Jay LaRose, who is almost in all of my movies, he plays that part. And I wanted him to be like kind of unrecognizable in it with his beard and his hair. But so we had a whole backstory. He's actually, we wrote him to be real. Okay. Like he's a real person. And, you know, our whole kind of backstory is that his daughter was one of these people that lived on the ranch.
Oh, okay.
And that she like disappeared and he doesn't know what happened to her. And his like life fell apart. And there was all these little things, because all these little things we talked about with him is that he was abusive with his daughter. Like he sexually abused his daughter. And that's like what put her on that path to join this cult. Oh. And he like felt responsible for it. And he kind of lost his sanity because of it. And he has this like, he has this belt filled with his daughter's underwear.
Oh,
from his belt. Yeah. It's like this rope filled, tied together. It's funny how these little things come together. Like with, you know, the costume department and stuff. But if you will look at the movie, we called him Panty Belt Patrick Black, And he's literally wearing a belt made of woman's panties.
Oh, wow. And,
but on the flip side, he has all this guilt for like losing his daughter. So he's being influenced by the spirits.
Yeah.
Like they keep letting him in to the building, but he's, okay. When he's in the back there looking through the boxes,
yeah.
He's searching for material on his daughter.
Okay. That's okay.
So like he still wants to know like where she is.
Gotcha. Okay. Cause yeah, I wasn't sure because, well, first I wanted to say, I love how he looks a lot like Charles Manson in this film. Like,
yeah.
The way his hair and his like facial hair looks, I was like, he kind of looks like Charles Manson. I didn't know if that was like a purposeful like thing, but.
Yeah. I mean, to a certain extent for sure. I mean, we wanted to really, you know, I mean, then we pushed it pretty far with his beard and.
Yeah. But the other thing that I had questions about was because, and the reason why I brought up like the fact if he is a real person or if she's just seen like another ghost, because she's the only one in the movie that ever sees him. I mean, she mentions him to the one other cop that comes and visits her, Officer Price. When he comes to visit, she brings up the fact that he's in holding, but he never sees him. And she's the only one that ever interacts with him. But then he's like, here 1 minute, like she goes outside because she hears like, you know, the banging on the door. So she goes outside. But then when she turns around, he's inside the lobby.
Yeah.
With that scene where he like pisses all over the floor, which I love that scene so much. Cause I love when she's like, do you know where you are, sir? You're in a police station. He's just like, shut up. It makes me laugh every time. Cause I love her reaction to it. When he starts peeing, she's just like, Jesus Christ. Like, she's like, I've had it. This is what I get on the first night that I'm here. This is my first shift. And this is what I have to deal with. I love it. But yeah, that was just something I wanted to ask you when I was watching the movie on most recent watch, was there were like wheels turning in my head. I was like, is she seeing like a live person, or is she seeing like a ghost that's kind of going through a past thing that happened or something?
Well, and I think everything in the movie we wanted to be up for interpretation. There's very little in the movie where you can like put your finger on it and say, well, that's real.
You right. Know?
Like when Jessica gets in the police station for the first time and Grip Cohen, he's like banging down the hall and he's like screaming, yeah. And she's like, hello. And he's yelling at her, yeah. You know, sometimes we're like, what is that all about? And I'm like, well, you know, he like, why does he ask her to turn around? I'm like, well, think about it. Like what happens to her later? Officer Price comes and he's dead. And what's he got? Uh-huh. He's got this wound on the back of his head.
Yeah.
So it's almost like that's a foreshadowing that he's been seeing spirits.
Oh.
And he's like, turn around. And she starts leaving. Right. And she starts walking away. He's like, no, I didn't say walk away. I said, turn around. And the second he sees that she's, oh, okay, you're real. He totally goes into the routine. Like, okay. You know, I'm not just seeing things. So, okay, well, welcome here. Let me shake your hand.
That blows my mind, actually, because I never thought about that. Because that was going to be my next question. I was like, I love his character, but yeah, what is up with that when she first gets there? Because he's just like kind of off his rocker. And when she gets there, he's like, turn around. No, don't walk away. And he's like, you know, being all kind of crazy. And I'm like, but now that you say that, I'm like, that actually makes perfect sense. Like I never.
Right, it makes sense, right?
Yeah. I never even thought to put that two and two together until you said that. And then, I mean, I figured he's probably had been seeing ghosts as well, but I just never thought that was like why he was asking her to turn around. Like, I just was like, he is off his rocker. He's kind of kooky.
And it's like when we wrote that scene, it wasn't the motivation to say, oh, this will be a cool callback later. The motivation was to like, start scaring people immediately. Like I wanted to start building that tension from 30 seconds into the movie.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's like, you know, this guy out of focus at the end of the hall banging on a locker and you're like, what the, like, it just starts that it makes her feel unwelcome and unsettled.
Yeah. And in turn, it makes us feel that way as well.
Yeah. And out of the loop, right? You're like, what am I missing?
Yeah. You're like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But yeah, like I love how this movie, once this movie starts going, it just keeps going and doesn't stop. It's pretty relentless. And I love the there was a scene specifically that I really love as well. It's towards the beginning of the film when she's kind of like exploring the police station, and she goes into the locker room and she finds the photo of her and her dad. And then she like goes to like leave and all the freaking lockers are open. That scene is so like chilling in the best way, because it's like, oh, whoa, I was not expecting that. Cause like she steps back and you get that like really cool wide shot that you guys did of the, just all the lockers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so effective. Like all the little scares that you do in this film are just as effective as the big ones. And I love the journey that we're taken on with this film, because just with, you know, what you were saying with the Officer Price, that scene, when he turns around and walks away and like the back of his head is just, that scene literally freaked. I remember looking to my sister and being like, I didn't like that. That freaked me out. Cause it was something that was not expected.
Yeah. And it's funny how like, you know, cause watching horror movies, and I think, you know, with Last Shift, we wanted there to be a variation of how people are scared. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, things like that, lockers being open and like reveals of these subtle things. It's not like those things haven't been done before. And that's why they're so, you know, back in, you know, the Haunting of Hill House and like from the 50s and movies from the 50s and 60s and before that, even they had to, you know, reading Edgar Allan Poe and stuff. It's like they had to scare people with sleight of hand, like a magic trick. Yeah. I might always say like any good horror gag is a magic trick.
Yep.
You know, it's about diverting one's attention or drawing their eye to something else and then, and then surprising them.
Yeah.
And things like that, you know, with that Officer Price scene, it's like, well, you know, we've seen gags like this before when you're like, you're not sure something's real and then it is. But what I really wanted to do with that scene is like, have you ever seen a movie where you're literally having like a romantic kind of flirtatious, like long scene that not only reveals this kind of cute little romance, but also this deeper layer with her dad, right? It's it's an emotional scene. And then suddenly at the end of it, you're scared.
Yeah.
After like this 5 minute sequence.
Which I thought was just so amazing the way you did that scene, because I feel like up until that scene, the audience has kind of been on the edge of their seats with just everything that's happened so far, because you get this, you get a few scenes before that, like the scene with her and the homeless guy in the cell. And that's like the first time you get like a glimpse of what, you know, Michael Payman and all of his followers look like. And I also want to, not to go off topic from what we were just talking about for a minute, but I wanted to also talk about the freaking makeup in this film. Like the way that they look in this film is absolutely terrifying. Like it just, the look of the, you know, the people when they're in that makeup is just so scary. Like, and I love how you get only like quick flashes of it. So sometimes you're not really sure what you're looking at. Like the part where she goes up to like the holding door and you see like the flash of like the person's face with the, yeah. There's just so many like effective, like, scares in this film that just, I don't know, you did it so brilliantly, and the makeup is so good and the effects are just amazing.
Lee Grimes was our makeup guy on that movie, who has, you know, he's worked for years, has worked with a lot of big talent, and he was working on The Walking Dead a lot at the time in Georgia, but he did, him and his team did all the effects at, you know, and they really blew it out of the park. And I, you know, it's funny because I love Predator a lot. That's, you know, one of my favorite movies growing up. And what that movie did so well is deliver on this alien creature in levels. You know, it's like when that movie starts getting, let's say, turns into a horror film, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a war movie that turns into a horror film, but it starts on these states. It's very, what's the word? It's very disciplined on its progression. you know, it's like first you see nothing,
mm-hmm.
and then you get a little glimpse of this, you know, see-through man monster. And then you see the alien, you know, you see his form, full form, and you're like, oh my God, that's Stan Winston. Like, holy shit, that's amazing. And then yeah. at the end of the movie, he takes off his mask and you're not even thinking about it. You're not even thinking about, right, oh, he's going to take off his mask. I didn't even, right. like, it. The progression is so disciplined. And, you know, a lot of monster movies are like, they'll give it all away in like the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And we wanted to be disciplined with that progression. So when you get to the end of the movie, you're like, oh, it's, you know, you're kind of like bombarded with it in the final yeah. moments.
Yeah. It's well, and yeah, like you were saying with the progression, I love how this movie progresses because it doesn't feel like this movie takes any stops that last too long. Like there aren't any scenes when I watch this film where I feel like, you know, I feel like this scene's dragging too long or this scene's not, you know, long enough. I just feel like the way you paced it and the way that you, you know, built it up to, you know, the climax is just so, so good. And I also love that scene where after she watches the tape that shows up on the TV when with the cult members, the scene where the chairs are going around her. And then you get like quick flashes of the, you know, them in the chairs as they're, it's so cool. Like it's so well done. Like everything in this film is so well done. But yeah, all of that, like leading up to the scene with Officer Price, when he shows up, I like how you did that scene because, you know, all this stuff has happened so far. So you're just kind of like so tense. And then it gives you a moment to kind of like, you know, relax yeah. because you're like, okay, this is kind of like a nice, you know, intimate kind of semi-romantic scene, but also kind of heartfelt because he brings up her father and talks about how, you know, a little bit of how they work together and how his dad, you know, died a hero that night kind of thing. So it kind of puts you in this like very, like, okay, this is a nice scene. And then, you know, as soon as he turns around to walk away, you're like, oh God.
Lulls you into a sense of safety.
Yeah. And then rips you right back out of it. Like the minute it happens and you're like, oh, okay, I did not like that. Cause it's just so unexpected. Like I never would have expected that. And then he turns around and it's just like, it still gives me, every time I watch that film, even on most recent watch, it still gives me chills every time because it's so effective.
Cool. Some behind the scenes, and it's funny because I look back on it and I'm like, I don't know why I did that. But some behind the scenes on when we shot that sequence, I was adamant about, I wanted the makeup on the back of his head. Number one, for scheduling reasons, like these are things you don't think about when, I mean, you do. It's all you think about when you're making the movie.
Yeah.
When you're watching the movie, you're not thinking about it. It's like you have a chance, you know, you have a question. Do you want to shoot the stuff? Because you have this actor who's in a scene and then you're either going to send him to makeup to get the back of the head done and go shoot, leave that location and shoot something else. Or you're going to like shoot the back of the head stuff first. And I hate doing that. I want to lead up progress. I want to lead up for the actors to the actual moment. So I was like, that's off the table.
Yeah.
And then, so what's my solution? Well, my solution is put the makeup on him first, get it done. And then we'll shoot the entire scene top to bottom.
Okay.
He wore that headpiece through the entire sequence. So when he's outside standing at the door, when he walks into the police station, when he gets into the scene, if you watch the scene, you'll see. And I said to him, I was like, this will add something that people will pick up on subconsciously because we're not cheating. We're not saying, oh, his head's fine. And then it isn't.
Yeah.
He wore that piece of makeup through the entire scene. So he had to be very cautious about how he was standing towards camera. So if you go back and watch the scene, you'll see how rigid he is.
Yeah.
Because he never wants to reveal his head to her because he can't, or we'll see it on the camera. You know, if he moves just the slightest left or right, you'll see it. So when he walks to camera and walks towards camera, he's always walking at this angle where you don't see the back of his head. And, you know, Lee is like, oh my God, like I got to keep, because, you know, you're under the you're in the heat, you're under the lights.
Yeah.
You're like, just turn around and show it already because my makeup's melting.
But I can feel it. Like,
we'll get there. We'll get there.
He's like, I can feel it peeling off the back of my head as we speak. Yeah.
And you know, Lee would have to come in and keep touching it up even before the reveal. And then we added some, you know, post effects to it as well. But you'll see these details if you go back and look or see how he, you know, I always like to think that scene, it's like these ghosts are almost imprisoned by the, you know, the Payman family.
Yeah.
And he, when he's talking about, you know, his dialogue is like, he's sneaking away to have a moment with this woman.
Yeah.
And then he's looking off in the distance. He's like, I gotta go. You know, it's like, what is he looking at? You know, he's feeling, oh, I gotta get out of here because they're coming, you know, these little things, but.
Yeah. And I love that you explain that because I don't know. I never realized that he was like even ever walking in a specific way. Like I didn't realize that, like, but now that's all I'm going to think about when I go back to watch it, I'm going to be like, wow, I had no idea that he was wearing that prosthetic the entire time. Like that scene is gone. That's so cool that you guys did.
Like, I'm ruining it for you.
No. I love that because now it's like, I can go back and watch it from a more fresh perspective. Because I'm fascinated with behind the scenes stuff. That was like one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to start this podcast is because I love movies. Don't get me wrong, but I also love, you know, from a technical filmmaker standpoint, I love how films are made. And that's like the first thing I do whenever I get a new film on DVD. Like, of course I've seen it already, but I will go and watch all the behind the scenes stuff because that fascinates me more so than the movie itself most of the time. Yeah. And so it's like, I love watching how films get made. I love watching behind the scenes stuff. Like
the behind the scenes stuff. And like, that's what got me into movies. It's like, you know, when I was a kid, you had to wait for like some PBS special and like the making of Star Wars and to see like the model making the miniatures and the behind the scenes stuff. And then when DVDs became the big craze, that was one of the huge selling points to DVD, the DVD market was the special features. Unfortunately now I feel like we're the last like 5 years and beyond, we still get special features, but we've lost that content.
Yeah.
Because when you look at those big, like, let's say like the first Iron Man, the first Pirates of the Caribbean, first and second Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Yeah.
Those DVDs have hours, like 6-7 hours of movie making. And like, it's great that the Mandalorian and, you know, Jon Favreau with the Mandalorian stuff is doing that again, kind of on their behind the scenes. You're seeing, they're putting tons of it on Disney Plus. But, you know, now you kind of get like, oh, here's a 7-minute making. It's still awesome, but it's like, here's a 10-minute making of or like a 30-minute. And in that like heyday of special features, when that was like, why you're like, oh, I'm going to buy this because of the special features. I love the movie, but the special features is what makes it great.
Oh, yeah. There was another point that I wanted to bring. Oh, so I read online that you guys actually also filmed an actual police station, which ironically in the trivia that I read, it said that the police station had been closed down and they had just built a new one. So it's like life imitating art. And I just thought that was really funny that, because I wasn't sure if you guys filmed at an actual police station or if you filmed like on it, like if the insides were all like sets. So I thought that was, I personally love it when films shoot on location. I prefer that. I mean, I understand why sometimes it's not possible because, you know, it's hard to, you know, get cameras in there and stuff to do the angles that you want if there's actual walls. So, but I just thought that was really cool that you filmed at an actual police station, once a working police station.
We didn't build any sets on that movie. I mean, our production our art department, they, you know, painted and dressed a lot, and then they built like cots for the cells because there weren't any, and we took them out. I don't think we used them. I don't think you even see them in the movie. But what was good is when we were writing the script, we like wrote it in a pretty quick timeline. And while we were writing, we were location scouting. Mm-hmm. So we found the location and then finished the script based on the location.
Oh, okay.
So we walked around and I would walk around and kind of pre-direct the scenes and think we would write it in the movie of, okay, this is how this will play out. This is how this will play out. So we could cater each scene in the script to the, to that police station.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. Cause I just love it when films shoot on actual location. I just think it's so cool. Cause you know, you get more of a real, not to say that sets don't look real or anything, but I just feel like you get more of a realistic feel when you're in an actual location shooting something. I don't know.
When it's funny, cause it's also like when you watch, I've had people comment on Last Shift. It's like, oh, it looks like, you know, some people was like, oh, where'd they shoot it? Cause it's not a police station. And I'm like, yeah, it's a police, you know, from watching movies, we get ideas in our head what a police station should look like.
Yeah.
But this is the, you know, that was the Sanford police station. We, you know, that sticker on the wall, we just left it there. You know, yeah. It was like half torn down, you know, and it's funny because what the building we shot at, the police station, it was segmented in two parts. On one side had already been this business had started opening up an office space in one part of the building. And then the other part of the large percentage of the building, they had not touched yet. So we shot everything in that part of the building. And it's all, you know, those yellow lockers were yellow lockers, you know, that, that gym was their gym. That was their, you know, locker room. And I loved it. Cause it was so like 70s. I'm like, this is great. This is, you know, this is like Kubrick, like yellow locker room. Perfect.
And that was something I also wanted to bring up. I felt with like a lot of the shots, like that locker shot specifically, where all the lockers are open, I did get like a very Kubricky vibe with a lot of the shot. Like I loved it. Like I love it. And I love I specifically really love the scene where she walks in and all the girls are sitting around in that circle in front of the little mirror and they're all singing. Was that an original song that you guys came up with? Cause I don't think I've ever heard that song like outside of that film.
It was. So the whole progression with that music, which I love, and the song in the end credits, I think is beautiful, which is the whole progression came from, again, the Manson family. So if you listen to the girls singing, right, they sung a lot. They'd sit in the courtroom while they were on trial and they'd sing these songs. And Manson was a musician.
Yeah.
You know, he had close ties to the Beach Boys and stuff like, not close ties, but you know, they were embroiled. They were embroiled in that whole time period. And so that was the inspiration, is like, I want a song like this. And we had taken the script and some lines in the script we gave to, Danielle White was one of the girls. She's one of the ghost girls. Mm-hmm. She had, I believe she had auditioned. She came in with a friend and they were both cast, this other girl, Mona.
Oh, that's cool.
They were cast in the movie. And then I think I found out that Danielle was a singer. And I said, hey, why don't you guys take the script? She had a really great voice. And I said, write a song around this style of folky music. So they took the script and saw like lines we had done and wrote that piece of music. And we had, you know, we had sessions with the girls practicing and they'd harmonize together and kind of wrote the song that way. And then we gave her song to a professional musician that Adam knew, but the original the piece of music that's in the end credits is, you know, is based on Danielle's song. And then but I love that piece of music. I wish I could, if we make a sequel to the movie, I'll use that song more because I think it's such a good piece of music.
And it's creepy. Like, it's so eerie. Like, the times when you do hear it, like, whether a character's singing it, whether you just hear someone whistling it, it's just a creepy, very creepy, like, I think it's really creepy when she's on the radio and she's trying to get a hold of somebody and you just kind of hear it go over the radio a little bit.
The crackle, like, yeah.
It's creepy. Like, there's just so many, and that, I just love this movie because there's so many of those moments. Like, there are really good scares in this film, but there's also, I love more so the underlining, like, uneasiness that it gives you. Like, it just makes you feel really, I don't know, it makes you feel some type of way, like some type of way that I don't want to sleep by myself or with the lights off. But yeah, and I also love the twists that there's a couple of twists in this film that I don't want to spoil for the listeners, because I think it would be fun to, as I discussed with you before we started recording, I think me and my sister would love to do a more in-depth discussion about this movie and then have you come back on again as like a guest if you'd like. But there's a couple of twists that kind of reveal themselves in this movie that I thought were really cool. One with one of the girls that she's talking to periodically throughout the film on the phone, you find out something about her. And then, like, the end when, like, the whole shootout in the police station happens, and then you find out, you know, it's just, I love the different places this movie goes. It's just such a good film, Anthony. Like, you did such a good job on it.
Thank you very much. And we've been talking about doing a sequel because we really want to explore the kind of Payman family more and kind of, again, do a lot of things based on sound design and things like that, which was such a big part of the movie.
Yeah, and that's another thing I wanted to bring up real quick too. I love the score in this movie. It reminds me, it gives me very Tom and Andy vibes.
Yeah.
Because I love the score to The Strangers. That's like one of my all-time favorite scores. And there's moments in this film where it sounds a lot like I, for a moment, I had to, like, look it up and be like, did Tom and Andy score any of this film? Because there's definite, like, vibes of that in there, and I love that.
I think I probably referenced, like, The Hills Have Eyes, you know, Tom and Andy's like that movie has a lot of great pieces by them. And you know, actually, I don't think I used The Strangers as a reference at all, but it makes sense. It's the same composers. But yeah, I love their music. With the sound effects and sound design in particular, and Michael Orlowski is, like, the brains behind what we did with the sound. And I worked with him on quite a few films, including Extremity, which we did with him too. And they, you know, we had such a great experience, and I've talked about this before on other things, and you can see some of it, I think, on the Blu-ray and stuff, but we did things. So our planning process, and because we wrote around this location, what we did in pre-production was we brought in the sound team and we had actors come in, some who appear in the movie and some who don't. We had a kind of like an old school, you know, radio show. We brought all the actors in the location. We spent a whole day shooting sound before we shot the movie. No, I take that back. It was all done right after we finished shooting the movie. I think it was the next day. We did a whole sound session of design work. So every sound you hear in that movie was recorded on that location. Every hinge squeak, every bang of a pipe, the sound guys went around and recorded all organically in that location. And then the whole actors we brought in, voice actor team we brought in, again, we shot all their voices were done in those hallways.
Wow.
And the screams, the whispers, the shouts, everything in the locations. And we set up a lot of improv where we would, I mean, it sounds crazy, but these things, you know, you kind of say, like, talk to your actors, you're like, well, what can we do? What are you willing to do? Like, so we'd have, like, like the Payman family, like dragging these actresses down the hall, screaming and like locking them in the prison cells. And like,
yeah,
but you create this environment of improv that builds this energy. Yeah. And we shut off the lights. So it was like completely pitch black, and you just be creative and like do crazy stuff and like sneak up on people, you know, in the complete darkness and record their natural reactions. Or like, I would go up to them and like whisper something to them and then disappear. And like, it was just crazy, but it was fun. And all that stuff was. So when I edited the film, I could build the whole sound design into the edit and then give it to the sound guys. And then they could take it, you know, 10 steps further.
Wow. And,
you know, that much better.
That's fascinating, because I love, like when you were just explaining that, I love how you have this way about doing everything just very naturally, very organically. Like you know, I love the fact that you guys spent an entire day just in that police station, just going around making noises from the actual police station. Because like, I don't feel like a lot of movies do that. I feel like a lot of movies, the sound design is within the, you know, in a studio, like in a Foley booth where they make the sounds, you know, with other things, you know? But I think that's so cool that's how you did it, because in the past when I've done, you know, little short films that I've done, I've always done that too. Like I've just taken the sounds naturally from, you know, wherever I'm filming stuff. And I just add that in there. And I just think that process is so, so cool, because it just shows how much time and work that you like put into making this film, and the creative ways that you've gone about, you know, making, you know, the process of this film, essentially, like the sound design, the filming, all of that. I just think that's so cool that, you know, you really took the time to do that. I think that's awesome.
I'm like obsessive compulsive when it comes to sound. I played drums, and when we're in sound mixing, and when I'm editing, if I edited the movie, or even if I didn't edit the movie and I'm watching, I become kind of obsessive with rhythms in sound. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so oftentimes when you get, you know, working with Michael so many times, he knows, like, if he takes out a sound and replaces it with a, like a cleaner sound or something that's in the library, I'm going to be like, what the hell is that? Like, get that out of there. And it's funny, because there's in Dread, the Clive Barker movie, right? There's this, and we had Glenn Fremantle did the sound design. They did Slumdog Millionaire, like literally just a year before they did Dread. Like we had an amazing sound team on that movie. And I love the sound in Dread, but there's a sound in that movie where he opens a locker, and you know, it's like a library sound effect. And because I'm so obsessive about sound, I've heard that sound in like 1,000 other movies. So every time I hear it, I have like this, like, that's the Dread locker sound. Like,
yeah. No, I'm exactly the same way. Like, I've noticed it a lot with like creaking door sound effects. And so when I listen to other movies, I hear those sound effects and I'm like,
I see you. I know that sound.
But when you were talking about how you're, you know, really OCD and with the sound and stuff, I'm the same way. Like I can pick up like specific sounds and be like, oh, I've heard that sound before, or, you know, so
it's useless talents we have.
Yeah. I'm like, if I could memorize and learn math equations like I can memorize and quote movies off the top of my head, I would be a freaking, you know, mathematician. But no, can't retain that stuff.
We're filmmakers, so just keep doing that.
And yeah. But is there anything else you wanted to say before?
No, I think I've, you know, gone on enough tangents, I guess. I think you got plenty to work with.
I think this was a fantastic episode, and I had so much fun recording this with you, and it's just been a dream, like talking to you and getting more of like a behind the scenes perspective, because as I said before, I never in a million years would have dreamed, like, just starting this podcast last year, I would be talking to you right now, like having an interview with you about one of my favorite horror films.
Instagram, it's like, hey, I got a podcast.
Yeah, you probably I you probably get reached out by people all the time, and you're probably like, oh, another one. Here's
I wouldn't be here if, you know, if I like it. I like talking about that, you know, because also it also, you know, keeps you invigorated about why we do these things.
Yeah.
Especially during this time.
Oh, yeah. Thank God for Zoom and Skype and all the, you know, technological advances that we have where we can actually communicate to each other this way. So,
yeah. Well, and it's, you know, listen, talking about movies we enjoy keeps us inspired by it, because it is crazy. You know, it's hard. We complain about these first world things about, like, but it is being, you know, my wife and I, we love movies. We see movies all the time.
Yeah.
And it, you get, there's a weight that it comes on you when you're like, wow, there's literally even on, you know, on online, to think that they have a whole like backlog of a year and a half of movies that they had to like push aside.
Yeah.
That, you know, we don't have that content right now. And it's, it does get, it wears on you when you search for that to be inspired.
Yeah. I hope you had a, fun time. Cause I had, I had a blast talking with you today. So
definitely.
And before we wrap this episode up, do you want to tell the listeners where they can find you at, Instagram, all that, plug yourself in a little bit?
I'm horrible with social media, but Instagram at Jesus Christ. Natalie, what's my Instagram? Anthony de Blasi, right? Is it Ant de Blasi or is it Anthony de Blasi?
Hello. I believe it's Ant de Blasi.
It's Ant de Blasi. All right. You're too slow, Natalie. All right. Yes. Instagram is like the only thing I update, which will update Facebook too, but Ant de Blasi, find me on Instagram. And when I make movies, I am pretty, you know, when I'm on a project, I update it a lot.
Yeah.
So you'll see things like that. We already got it. Ant de Blasi.
Late to the party.
Yeah, late to the party.
Oh, man.
Last to drink.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you again, Anthony, for wanting to do this episode with me. It's been a blast. I know we've talked about in prior conversations about you coming back on again, just to have like a normal movie discussion, which I would love to do with you at some point. So
yeah, I'm down.
So
yeah, I'm down.
But yeah, that's all we have for this episode. Thank you again, Anthony, for wanting to come on. I really appreciate it. And it's been a blast. So
thanks for having me, Michael.
Of course.
And we had a blast. We love horror podcasts.
Yes. And we will see you guys later. Bye.
Bye.